While we're here in Lamentations 3, it would be good to remind ourselves of the cumulative effect of redemptive history. First, you get a story in Genesis like Joseph, which is all about how bad things happen to a good man under the providence of an all-orchestrating God to bring good out of it in the end. And then you get story after story. You get Job, you get Ruth. And so the prophets learn these things. They know these things. Prophets didn't just learn their theology out of the blue in a moment, boom, with an inspiration. It was an accumulative effect of redemptive history and a history of revelation that God used when he inspired these men. And so here we are in chapter 3 of Lamentations, which is hard to find because it's so tiny, sandwiched in there at the end of Jeremiah. And you not only have in that chapter this phenomenal statement that the mercies of God are new every morning in the worst possible circumstance of Jerusalem being under siege and women eating their own children. I think that's the worst thing that happens in this book, emotionally. But you also have verses 37 and 38, where the prophet says, "Who is there who speaks, and it comes to pass unless the Lord has commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that both good and ill go forth?" So here we have a Naomi lesson. It's a Naomi lesson. He learned this from somewhere. He didn't make this up. Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that good and ill, that is blessing and calamity, go forth? He didn't have the world carved up. This is the part that God does, and this is the part that Satan does. This is the part that God does, and this is the part that free will does. He didn't carve up the world that way. That is not the way the biblical writers saw the world. God is God over all things. There's no season, there's no moment when he drops Satan's leash. He loosens it, and he tightens it. He never drops it. And so I at least am going to commend to you a vision of God for survival in your bitter providences that is different than some solutions that are offered these days very popularly in our land. And I see it everywhere in the Bible, and I see it in almost all hymns. There are very few hymns that celebrate the free will of man. Strike you as odd? It's not something to be celebrated for a very simple reason. If you have it, you'll die. It'll kill you. You are free to do one thing, go to hell. If you escape, it will be because God's glorious grace has triumphed over your will, which is dead and enslaved to sin. That's why we don't celebrate it. We just bring it in to solve problems, and it's not a very good solution. So, we'll say more about that in a minute. But, Marty, you're the fault for this first 5 minutes here. You chose the hymn, you chose the text. It's a horrible, horrible book. And at the middle of this horrid book of weeping and lamenting and Babylonian captivity and horrid things going on, that hymn was born. And that's where most hymns are born that mean anything to us. They're born out of pain. Most hymns that move us deeply were written by people who have walked through fire. "It Is Well With My Soul," we sang last night, and you know the story behind that. I won't go into that. All right, here we are. Let's go back and pick it up where we left off. We're right near the end of chapter 1. We're going to take a few more minutes on it, then read chapter 2. And I think we can finish chapter 2 this morning and be on track. But here we are I said Ruth is an ideal woman, gave you several reasons why, because of her wonderful response there of faith in God and freedom from the securities and comforts of her homeland, ready to courageously go out and venture something new in the unknown, and radical commitment to Naomi that is just amazing, and to Naomi's God, even though Naomi's God, according to Naomi, is against her. He's against her, and she says, your God will be my God. So here's a woman who had embraced a great sovereign God. And while I'm on the ideal woman, let me just quote one verse from Proverbs 31, which is the chapter everybody thinks about when they think about the ideal woman. This is my favorite verse in that chapter. Verse 25 of Proverbs 31 says, strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the future. Think on it. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the future. I think that means when she contemplates all the pain and all the happiness that the future may bring, she is in the future's face with laughter. You think you're going to threaten me, given what I have tasted of God and His sovereignty and His goodness, future? Try me. And she laughs at the future. She doesn't cower before the future. She doesn't murmur about the future. She doesn't cravenly worry about the future. She laughs at the future. Try me. Test me. Given what I have seen of God and what I know of God, go ahead. Make my day, future. So that's my vision of the ideal woman. Strength and dignity are her clothing. And she walks into the future. She walks from Moab and everything she's known, grown up with, experienced as a married woman for 10 years, or in a widow, and she leaves it all to head for that place where there used to be a famine and where Naomi says, I can't give you anything. And in fact, we're going to find out she doesn't give her anything. She's got to go out and beg as soon as she gets there and pick up pieces of grain left over from the rich people. But I don't want to get ahead of myself here. Let's finish chapter 1. We're at verse 20. Naomi's going to return now. She's resolved. She goes back. She arrives in Bethlehem. The women come out, and they're amazed. They've seen her for at least 10 years, probably more. Is this Naomi, they say there, verse 19. And now she says in verse 20 and 21, don't call me Naomi, pleasant. Call me Mara, bitter. Remember the waters of Mara, next book of Exodus, the waters of Mara, the bitter waters. Call me Mara. For the Almighty, now she makes four statements here. Now we have to decide, is her theology right here or wrong? Number one, the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord, this is number two, has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when, number three, the Lord has afflicted me or testified against me? Number four, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me. Now, what do you make of this theology? Naomi has a theology. There's one thing she knows for sure. In fact, there are three things she knows for sure. Number one, God exists. It never enters her mind. In fact, atheism is just not an issue in the Old Testament. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Nobody else thinks that way. So no matter what happens to you, that's not one of the solutions. There's no God. That's just not on the agenda. So that she's sure of. Number two, she is sure he's almighty. He's God. And number three, she is sure he's the one who afflicted her. She's sure of those three things. Is she right? Well, the author doesn't say she's wrong. Is she right? I think the aim of this book is to say she's right in her vision of the sovereignty of God, and she's wrong to say that he brought her back empty. You see that in verse 21 at the beginning. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. In other words, she has been so oppressed and defeated and discouraged and hurt by the six hammer blows we mentioned last night of painful, bitter providences that she's blind to what God is up to in her life. She won't let go of her faith. He's God, he's sovereign, he's done it, I'm going home, I'm not rejecting him, but I'm empty. And I think this book is written to say, believe that way, but let the whole story teach you she wasn't empty when she came back. She had Ruth. She had Ruth loving her, and this Ruth was going to serve her till the day she died, and she did serve her. Naomi may have had a bad back or who knows what. She didn't go down to Boaz's field to glean. Ruth served her. Ruth was going to go get food. Ruth was going to take the initiative to make sure they didn't starve. She wasn't empty. She had Ruth. And she had forgotten she had a Boaz back there. She had a distant relative. She had two, in fact, and they didn't come into her mind. They will in chapter 2. We're going to watch Naomi become the theologian in chapter 2. Naomi becomes the good theologian in chapter 2, and I'll point it out when we get there. The lights go on in chapter 2, and a providence of how it is that Ruth just happened to go to the field of Boaz, that's got to be interpreted. And who gives the interpretation? Naomi will give the interpretation. So there's a season of darkness. There's a season of blindness. There's a season of short-sightedness in this woman's right theology that's got to be cleared up. That's why the book is written, I think. To say, yes, God is sovereign, but if you have only a sovereign God, you're going to go around saying, and I am empty under his heavy sovereign hand, which is not true. It's not true of anybody in this room. You are not empty. You feel empty. You are not empty. And this book is written to give you hope that you are not empty. No, the Lord has not brought her back empty. She made that mistake, and the book is written to correct. So let me sum up chapter 1 with four lessons that I was intending to do last night, but I'll use them as transition now to chapter 2. Lesson number 1, God the Almighty reigns in all the affairs of men. This is an assumption of this book. It's everywhere, and it's taught there and in all those other parts of the Old Testament that we've been mentioning along the way. He rules nations, and he rules families. He rules in your kitchen, and he rules in the U.S. Congress. He never drops the ball. Whatever they doubted, they didn't doubt this in the Old Testament. God was involved in every part of their lives. Nobody could stay his hand. He gave rain, and he took rain. He gave life, and he took life. We live and move and have our being in this God from the toothpick to the Taj Mahal. Nothing is properly understood out of relationship with the sovereign God. We're going to find Boaz little statement from Boaz that shows how utterly God-besotted this man is. God-saturated he is. So when I say toothpick to Taj Mahal, I'm trying to cause you to get all compartmentalization out of your life. Like you got a God compartment that can handle the beauty of a Taj Mahal. But toothpicks, we just use those to, you know, pick our teeth. They don't have anything to do with God. They have everything to do with God. Came from trees. So did your teeth come from God. And the food that's between them came from God. And everything has to do with God. And one of the functions of the Bible is to make us a God-besotted people. Number two, lesson number two. God's providence is sometimes very hard and very bitter. And it's not wrong to call it that, as long as you're not faulting him and becoming angry at him. It's not right to be angry at God. I'll say that again. I mean that. It's not ever right to be angry with God. It is right to say you are if you are. Do you make that distinction? It's never right to be angry with God, ever. It's a sin to be angry with God. But it's right to say you're angry to God if you are, because hypocrisy doesn't make it any better. Two wrongs don't make a right. So if you're angry, repent and tell him you're angry and ask for forgiveness and ask him to give you more trust in his goodness in the thing that's making you angry. No sense playing games with God. So there are many hard providences. Many are the afflictions of the righteous. And the Lord delivers him out of them all. It's not always sin that brings us into our afflictions. Many of our afflictions are not owing to sin in the specific instance of the doing of them. Maybe to original sin, but not specifics. Third, his purposes in all of our afflictions are for our good and for the ultimate happiness of his people. This is happening in the worst of times here, and quietly God is working through the pain of a little family. Now it's reduced to just a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law. That's all that's left. And in that, he's working. He's working to do something incredible. And right now, wherever you are in your pilgrimage from the famine to Obed, That's the pilgrimage here. Obed the son, born to Ruth and Boaz, happily married, and yet, oh, the painful pathway that had to get there. Wherever you are on that, you may be just heading for Moab. 10 years are in front of you. Or you may be just coming back from Moab. Or maybe the baby's just been born in your life, and you're dancing for joy. And wherever you are on that, this book is written to keep you on that path and not let you leave it. It takes sometimes years to understand some of the reasons for the calamities. I'm giving an illustration. This was real pointed for me because of my sister, my father. I have one older sister. She lives in Charlotte. And my mother was killed in 1974. In a bus accident in Israel, and my father was very seriously injured in the same bus accident. He survived. I can remember in the ambulance, 10 days later, the body was in a hearse behind, the ambulance was in front. I was sitting with my father in the ambulance, and my mother's body was being behind, and as I sat there nursing my father, who was still very seriously injured, he just kept crying, saying, "Why me? Why me? Why am I spared? Why am I alive? Why did I stand up just as the collision happened, so that the lumber that came through the windshield didn't hit me in the face. What's the purpose? There must be a purpose. Now, that was 27 years ago. At my father's 80th birthday, which was last year, the ministry that he has come to lead gave him a retirement party. He's very slow to stop working. He's still working. This ministry had grown up about 5 years after my mother's death in a way that nobody dreamed, kind of a mission that he leads, and 40,000 students around the world involved in correspondence courses. And the board of his ministry invited me to come speak at my father's 80th birthday retirement banquet. And I said, I would cross the galaxy to do this on a weekend. And so, yes. And I stood up and I said, not many sons get to preach at their father's funerals. Everybody, what does that mean? What does that mean? I said, and that's what I'm going to do here. Because I've spoken at so many funerals and I've heard so many sons and daughters and uncles and aunts get up at funerals and say, I wish Daddy could hear me say this, or I wish so and so. I say, I'm going to say everything right now that I wished I had said when I speak at his funeral. And he's sitting here, and my sister is here. And so I just laid out 10 reasons why I love my dad and what good he's done for me, and I closed by pointing out that this ministry here with these 300 people at this banquet supporting this ministry would never have happened had my mother lived, because my father was on a very different trajectory of ministry and this would not have come into being, and therefore here's one of probably 10,000 good reasons that God had that I do not know about why my mother was taken at age 56 and my father not. When I was done, my sister's just weeping at the table. And she's 3 years older than I am. And when I walked down, I wasn't sure what I was going to hear. But she gave me this big hug, and she said, I never have seen any good in it. I never have seen any good in it. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. So she's really struggled with this. And I don't think my sister has the depth of theology on this issue that I would like her to. And if she ever hears this tape, Beverly, read the pleasures of God. And let's talk about it. Because there are a lot of churches that teach this. That help saints get ready to handle bitter providences in a God-exalting, God-centered way. So yeah, I think there are reasons for why my mother was taken, as many reasons as I can think of why she shouldn't have been. And still to this day, I have sons who are now my age that I was when my mother died, that I would like to ask questions about because of my life. And my dad wasn't around as much as my mother was, and therefore he can't answer my questions about what I was like when I was 14 or 15 or 20 or whatever. And I would like to be able to have that insight so I can understand my sons better, but isn't there. The amputation happens, you'll never get that arm back. You'll never have her back, and you have to trust there are other things. There are other things God is doing, and they are right, and they are good. So that's the third point. The purposes in these hard providences are good for us and good. And lastly, if you believe this, if you laugh at the future, if you're that kind of woman or that kind of man, you will be one of the freest, most risk-taking, sacrificial, gutsy, ministers in the world. I don't mean clergy either. I mean doing the hard thing in life for the good of other people. Like Ruth, you leave your homeland, you commit yourself to somebody, you stay in the commitment, you go to the hard, unknown place because you've got a great sovereign God who rules the world and lets nothing befall you but what is good for you, even if it hurts. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. That produces a certain kind of man and a certain kind of woman with radical allegiance and sacrifice and commitment. We need more of them. There's so much soft Christianity in the world today. And I'll tell you, the Great Commission is not going to be finished by soft, middle-class, American, secure, comfortable Christianity. It's going to be finished by risk-taking, lay down your life, martyr-like women and men. And a little namby-pamby theology isn't going to produce that kind of people. Sermons that just coddle people and try to make them happy that they're in church that Sunday and make them feel good about their jobs and their families, and just a feel-good theology that doesn't have any spikes in it and no fiber in the trunk, it's just going to blow over. It's just going to produce touchy-feely kind of, oh, poor me Christians who don't take any risks and don't do anything hard and who always blame God when things go wrong and try to give him praise when things go right and know they're hypocritical. Well, I'm not interested in furthering that kind of mushy Christianity. I'm much, much, much more interested in Ruth, her kind of person and her kind of theology, Naomi's kind of theology, the Bible's kind of theology. So let's go to chapter 2. Barley harvest. They came at the end of the barley harvest, which is just full of hope. She's got Ruth. She doesn't realize what a blessing that is. She's too oppressed at this point. She's got a home now. People are recognizing her. Now what? Well, in chapter 2, the mercy of God is going to become so obvious that Naomi wakes up to it and gives the best interpretation of it. So let's read the whole chapter together. Now, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set forth and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. A remarkable understatement. She happened to come. We'll come back to that and ask, what's the right interpretation of that happening? Did it just happen? What's this writer doing in saying it that way? Who in this chapter will come back at the end and interpret that statement correctly? And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was the family of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." That's just amazing. I can hardly wait to do the exposition until I read the whole chapter here, because it's just so good. To say, out of the 10,000 things you could report in a story that lasts for 20 years, you would report that? The greeting? Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose maiden is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "It's the Moabite maiden who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Pray let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she's continued from early morning until now without resting even for a moment." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my maidens. Let your eyes be upon the field which they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to molest you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, Why have I found favor in your eyes? Now that question's got to be answered. We'll come back. What's the answer to that question? Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me when I am a foreigner? But Boaz answered her, All you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told me, and how you left your father and your mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord recompense you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Then she said, You are most gracious to me, my Lord. For you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not one of your maidservants. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her parched grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. And when she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her. So she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned. This is a hard-working woman. All day long she gleans, and when she's finished, she doesn't even stop. She beats the grain out. It was about an ephah of barley. She took it up, didn't ask any boy to take it up. She took it up and went into the city, and she showed it to her mother-in-law, what she had gleaned, and she also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. She'd saved her lunch. She saved her lunch for Naomi. Where have you worked? Where'd you glean today? In verse 19. Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. Now pause here for just a minute. I think between verse 19 and 20, something almost like a new birth happens for Naomi. Boaz. And everything comes alive, or starts to. This is the point where Naomi sees light, sees hope. And the next words are really quite amazing. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, Blessed be he, Boaz, by the Lord, whose kindness, now, very crucial grammatical question. What is the antecedent of the word whose? What are the possibilities? Give me one. Boaz and God. Which is it? Very important question. I'll tell you what I think in a moment. Come back to that. Blessed be he by the Lord whose, either Boaz's or the Lord's kindness, has not forsaken the living and the dead. Naomi also said to her, The man is a relative of ours, one of our nearest kin. And Ruth the Moabite said, Besides, he said to me, You shall keep close to my servants till they have finished all my harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, It is well, my daughter-in-law, that you should go out with his maidens, lest in another field you be molested. So she kept close to the maidens of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law. All right, let's go back and take it up a section at a time. Verses 1 to 7, three things we see here. We meet Boaz, number one. We see the character of Ruth, number two. And we see a very merciful providence behind the whole scene. Let's talk about Boaz for just a minute. Boaz is a relative of Elimelech. And that means that the bleak picture that Naomi had described, there's nobody who could marry you that could fulfill Chilion's name, is wrong. There is somebody. She was blind. She forgot. There's Boaz. And it's a bright crack now in the clouds of bitterness. Verse 1 says he's a rich man. Verse 4, here's that amazing thing. He's a godly man. I think if you ask, why did he choose to quote this little greeting? Verse 4, and behold, Boaz came to Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered back, "The Lord bless you," is to say something like this. This man's business is so God-saturated that he relates to his employees and his employees relate to him in an utterly God-besotted way. He greets them with God. They greet him back with God. God is all over this man's life. That's why just a little thing like a greeting makes a big difference. So we have a rich man who's a godly man, and of course, the way he treats Ruth is full of portent about his own growing affections for her and the dignity and care with which he wants to care for this woman, although he addresses her as daughter. Shows he's older, and it sort of puts the brakes on our libido. Like, is anything going to happen here or not? Why is he calling her daughter? That's not what you call possible wife. So this writer is very delicate in the way he's moving us towards that evening where she goes and lies down beside him in the middle of the night. He's going to handle this very carefully and get us ready. Which, by the way, this just comes to my mind. I should keep my mouth shut on things like this, but I'm a real prude when it comes to movies and stuff. I don't even like kissing. Amen. Because that's somebody's daughter rubbing her mouth all over that guy's mouth. Now, I just imagine the implications of such an unbelievably unrealistic statement as this. I mean, it shuts Hollywood down. It's just over. It's history. And most drama and everything. Well, so what? You know? That's just where I am. I don't want my little girl, Calica, rubbing her mouth all over anybody's mouth but one. Not mine. Her husband's. Period. The point is this. There's a movie called A River Runs Through It. You ever heard of that movie, A River Runs Through It? I love that movie because I've got those two boys. I've got those two boys. The literature, University of Chicago, and the kid who got himself killed because of his temper. I know those two boys. They're my sons. And the dad is a Presbyterian Sovereignty of God preacher. I'm a Baptist Sovereignty of God preacher. That movie just kept, I went to see it as a family. I took the family to see this movie. And you know what? There's a girl in the movie in love with the older son. And they take a walk before he has to decide whether to stay in the hometown and be her husband in a kind of hometown way or go to the big city at the University of Chicago and get a degree in literature and fulfill a dream. And they walk off together into the orchard. Everybody wondering, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And I'm getting ready. Here, I got my whole family here for this scene that's coming. And they stand this far apart from each other. And he's full of romance and full of emotion. And they don't even kiss. There was not one kiss in this movie. And it was one of the most romantic, sexually powerful movies I've ever seen, I think. Nobody took his clothes off. Nobody touched anybody inappropriately, except the second son beat people up. And they stood there, and this moment, and the camera fades away, and they go their own way. Which all said to me, in parenthesis, is that very powerful, beautiful, glorious things about this wonderful thing called sex that God created can be done even in drama without. Okay, enough of that. Where am I? Boaz, Ruth, let's just talk about Ruth for a minute. Thank you that some of you feel that way too. Ruth, we got Boaz as a wealthy, godly man. Now, what about Ruth? What do we learn about Ruth here? The character of Ruth comes out powerfully in this. Number one, I see three things. Number one, Ruth's initiative to care for her mother-in-law. You see this in verse 2? Let me go to the field and glean along the ears of grain. Not, good grief, I wish I hadn't come here. I didn't know how poor we were going to be. And what are you going to do? I mean, you know people in this community. How do you get food here? How do Jews do this? I'm a Moabite. I mean, that's the attitude so many people have when hard times come. And Ruth, she's a capacious person. Her heart is big. She's not going to feel sorry for herself. She looks at the situation. She measures the possibilities. She sees what poor people do. And she says, let me go pick up pieces of grain and we'll have something to eat. So she's an initiative taker, not a, oh, poor me woman who, when she gets into difficult circumstances, feels sorry for herself. Secondly, she's an incredibly humble young woman. No presumption in this woman at all. No rights demanding. Verse 7, the servants, they report to Boaz that she had said, when she came early in the morning, she said, pray, let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. Not she did it, you know, on the sly, or she just did it because poor people have a right to do it, because the Old Testament says they have a right to do it. She asked to do it. She says, would this be okay? She's a humble, she's a meek person, strong as an ox, obviously, works all day and carries the grain home at the end, but strength and meekness are such a beautiful combination. She reminds me at this point of another woman who was a foreigner who once said, yes, Lord, but even the dogs eat from the crumbs under the master's table. And Jesus responded to that by saying, I haven't seen faith like that in Israel. For that statement, go your way, your daughter's healed. For that statement, Jesus loves humility. He hates rights demanding in men and women. Demanding, demanding, demanding. You owe me this, you owe me this, you owe me this, you owe me this is my right. That whole demeanor is displeasing to the Lord, whereas the willingness to suffer, you know, sometimes it's just scorn, like doormat theology. Everybody knows the difference between a strong, meek person and a wimpy, doormat kind of person who has no strength within. We know when submission and when meekness and when asking for permission rather than demanding a right is coming from strength or not. The third observation I would make about Ruth is her industry. She took initiative and she was humble, not presumptuous, and now industry. Verse 7, she has continued from early morning until now without resting, even for a moment. And then verse 17 says she went on gleaning even until evening. And then it says she, when she was done gleaning, she beat out the grain. So she took all what she picked up and got the grain out of it so she didn't have to take all the chaff home. And then she hauled it home with her lunch bag to Naomi and gave it to her. Long day. So, initiative taker, humble, meek, not presumptuous, and very, very industrious. That's the qualities we see. Now, what's the merciful providence? We've met Boaz. We've seen some qualities of Ruth. Now, what's the merciful providence here? Verse 3, so she set forth and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to a part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. She happened to. I think this writer is subtle here in letting you test yourself as to whether you're catching on to the point of this book. He doesn't get in your face here and say, have you got it? Here's the point. God took her to the field. There's the providence of God here. He just says she happened to come there. And you're left to answer, what do you believe about this? What do you believe about this? Do you believe accidents happen? Do you believe God just has nothing to do with such things? Or do you believe that the providence of God, which is what this book is about, is over little things like as you're working around, you come to the part of the field that happens to be owned by the one who you'll marry someday and who will bear a child who will bear the father of the King of Israel, who will be the father of the Messiah. Just happened to show up at this field. What's your view of God here? This is a test for the reader to ask. The rest of the book will, I think, bring great clarity. And Naomi's the one who's going to bring that clarity in a moment. But I think for those of us who have read the Bible, we ought to say, a man's mind plans his way, Proverbs 16:9, but the Lord directs his steps. So I try to help people, young people especially, who are trying to figure out the will of God for their lives, to say, love God and do as you please. That is, don't fret too much. God's going to direct your steps. Your main business is holiness. Love Him. Devote yourself to Him. Be in the Word. Be in prayer. Want to be a holy person. Keep yourself free from sin. As far as these decisions, where shall I go to school? What shall I study? Etc. Don't fret about that. God is going to guide His holy people. And you will know. You will know. Verse 8, Boaz, 8 and 9, Boaz approaches Ruth and shows her great kindness, provides food for her and protection to her and a thirst. So the tide is clearly turning here. I'm going to come back to that, verse 3, in a minute. But I want to go next to the question in verses 10 to 13 about why these good things have happened to her. She fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me when I am a foreigner? Now, before I answer that question, why? I mean, an answer is given here. We need to see if we understand it. Let me observe something about this woman that's so beautiful, and I'm sure these things are meant to be seen and embraced by us. She's astonished that he's nice to her. Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me when I'm a foreigner? She's just the opposite of the folks in Luke 13 who came to Jesus and said, what about those people whose blood Pilate mingled with their sacrifices? How do you handle that problem of evil, Jesus? I remember hearing a sermon by R.C. Sproul on this text that just blew me away years ago. Really helpful. Called The Misplaced locus of astonishment. R.C. Sproul, right. The misplaced locus of astonishment. So here are these people who are astonished that something so horrid would happen, that Pilate would, with his soldiers, crash in, and here are some Jews offering sacrifices, and he kills them and puts their own blood in with their sacrifices to make mockery of the whole system. And they come to Jesus and say, "Oh, what a horrible thing." They're astonished. And Jesus gives an answer that is absolutely mind-boggling to people who have another kind of theology. Jesus says, "Do you think that these people are any worse sinners than the rest of the people in Galilee? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will likewise perish." That's not what we came for. We came to get help with the problem of evil. And then he adds it. He says, "And do you think that the 18 people on whom the Tower of Siloam fell," this must have been being talked about in the community. This tower, it just fell over like a collapse of a building, say, after an earthquake. Do you think that those 18 people who were crushed by the Tower of Siloam were worse sinners than anybody else? No, but unless you repent, you shall all perish that way. What is he saying? He's saying, you know what you should be astonished at? That you weren't under the tower. No, they weren't any worse sinners than you. You should have been under the tower. And the fact that you're astonished that bad things happen to bad people shows that your astonishment is misplaced. You should be astonished that when you got up this morning, you were breathing. Breathing? You're in paradise. Everything in my apartment down there at the Shepherd's Inn is flawless. Just hot water, just push it this way, hot, push it this way, cold. It's incredible. Just flip a switch, light, flip a switch, dark. I can make the temperature go up, down, like this. It's usually too cold for me, so I'm pushing it that way. Lights, bed, pillow, one to go between my knees even. I learned to do that when my wife was pregnant. You're in paradise here. Is any of you astonished that you're here? Absolutely astonished that you're not in hell. You're on the outskirts of paradise. And you know what? Some of you are murmuring. The hill is steep. I'm so sorry for you. We are murmurers to the core. So Ruth, thank you. Thank you, Ruth, for falling down and saying, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me?" She just models for us the astonishment at grace. I'm astonished that I have been treated so kindly. I mean, here's a woman who's begging. She's poor. And she's astonished that she's being dealt such a kindness in the midst of her long, hard, sweaty, painful day by which she gets one day's food, maybe a few days' food. Oh, what a need we have in the church to stop murmuring. You know, it says in Philippians chapter 2, about verses 15 following, that saints are to shine like the stars in the sky because they don't murmur. Put away all murmuring, complaining. Be astonished at every good thing that happens to you. The reason we're so hypercritical, the reason we're so complaining, the reason we murmur so much, the reason we find so much fault with our spouses is because we have a misplaced astonishment. We're astonished when bad things happen to us and generally blame somebody. We ought to be astonished at the 10,000 good things that happen to us and understand that the bad things would be a lot worse if we got what we deserved. C.J. Mahaney, who's one of my friends and favorite people, and I see that I've just told too many stories to finish this chapter as well, so we'll just stay behind until the last day. But I'll finish this one and then we'll take our break. C.J. Mahaney is a pastor in and around Washington. He, whenever anybody says, "How you doing, C.J.?" You know what his answer is? "Better than I deserve. Better than I deserve." He says that answer has brought him more evangelistic opportunities than anything he's ever said. You know, somebody walks by and says, "How you doing?" He says, "Better than I deserve." And they say, "Why? What's wrong?" "Well, I'm a sinner before a holy God, and he sent his son into the world to die for me." I mean, it's just a perfect sentence. "Better than I deserve." Which is always true. It's always true. And if you don't believe that, you've got a very wrong understanding of grace and of sin. And you need to have Ruth work on you a little bit here. Okay, now I have not paced myself well again. And let me just see where we'll pick it up here. We're going to answer the question tonight. We'll do question and answer here in a half an hour. And you can go anywhere you want with that. But tonight we're going to pick it up and we're going to ask, what is the theological answer? It's a very profound one. In fact, it's an answer that will undergird the book of Romans, I believe. You think this afternoon about the answer, why have I found favor in your eyes? And why has God behind you favored me in this way? And is the answer given in verses 11 and 12 a gospel answer? Is it a legal answer? What's the bottom line answer to the why question of verse 10? And that's where we'll pick it up. So let's just pray and then we'll take our break and then come back for Q&A. Father in heaven, I want so much to be what I just described, and it's easy for me to describe it because I know my shortcomings so badly with my own children and my own wife that I am emotionally triggered by being crossed more vehemently than I am by being blessed. And I repent and confess how I am wired to complain and wired to criticize rather than being wired to be astonished that good things happen to me and thus leaping with joy of gratitude at every good thing that you are so mercifully pleased to let come our way. So, Lord, do a deep work here. All of us need to become more humble, more grateful, more meek, more upbuilding, and let no evil word come out of our mouth, but only what is good for edifying, that it may minister grace to those who hear. Make us gracious to each other now, even in the break time and between couples and among friends and everywhere we meet each other. May grace be tumbling from our mouths. Make our mouths a fountain of life to one another in these days, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.